If you've ever been to a protest in Vancouver, then you've probably stood right on top of it. Hundreds, maybe thousands of paintings, sculptures, archival photographs of the West Coast, all hidden underneath the dirty shoe soles of angry protesting Vancouverites.
Another anti-mask protest in downtown Vancouver.
Anti-police brutality protests.
The crowd of hundreds assembled at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
Vancouver Art Gallery.
Vancouver
this afternoon.
Art Gallery last night.
The Vancouver Art Gallery has a collection of around 12,000 pieces of artwork. Some of them are stored in a warehouse somewhere off-site. But a lot of it is actually stored right in the basement of the gallery, right underneath the plaza where people gather for protest, like a secret art dungeon, if you will.
It does feel very crammed. There are like big high shelving units that are just full.
This is Mandy Jensen, who is the assistant curator of the collections at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
If you want to actually access an artwork that's hanging on a screen, you pretty much have to do a kind of Tetris puzzle of moving crates to get into that space. Photos and prints, they might be in drawers or in boxes.
At this point, I thought, what's a photograph doing in a drawer? If we have the piece in the collection, shouldn't we display it? Isn't that the whole point of art? What even is the value of art then, if it's not being shown to anyone? So on average, what percentage of the collection is actively shown somewhere?
So on average, it's about 5% of the collection that's on display, which I know seems incredibly low, but it does seem to be kind of the norm. If you do some research, it seems like 5% to 7% seems to be the average for a lot of museums.
5%. There's something just disturbing to me about imagining Emily Carr's Big Raven just tucked away neatly on a shelf. And yet almost every museum in the world does this. The Louvre, the Met, just works of art labeled and stored in shelves, in boxes, in drawers, out of the gaze of anyone except for museum staff and maybe the occasional researcher. But what intrigued me more about this 95% invisible collection is its assigned worth from the gallery. Here is the financial report from the Vancouver Art Gallery in the year 2019 to 2020. Under page 66, notes to financial statements. Quote, the value of the collection for both items purchased and contributed has been excluded from the statement of financial position except for a nominal carrying value of $1. End of quote. Instead of trying to assess the value of their 12,000 pieces of artwork, the Vancouver Art Gallery has instead assigned an arbitrary value of $1 for their collection in their financial statements. It's like running a car dealership without knowing the value of the cars that you own. Again, this is apparently all common practice in the museums and galleries around the world. The institutions either assign an arbitrary value of something like $1 or just straight up exclude their collection from their financial statements. They exclude the one thing that makes the museum a museum. But I get it. For art, maybe it's different. Art is subjective and it's valued differently than a banana, even though some case it could be a banana. It's hard enough as is to put a price tag on a single piece of art, and much more so if we're talking about an entire collection of 12,000 pieces of artwork, 95% of which isn't even shown to the public. Does a painting depreciate in value if it's not being displayed? If a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, did it really make a sound? So then I look on the opposite spectrum of galleries, which is the internet. You see, one of the problems that the internet solves, and arguably one of the problems that it creates, is that the doors of the art vault have been opened, and anyone can own a virtual gallery where everyone can come and see everything regardless of what time it is or where you're located in the world. it's a great tool for artists, you know, especially young artists who have access to an audience. My good friend Fia is one of those artists.
I have an Etsy where I sell some prints and I sell bookmarks that I make. It has been pretty busy in the past, but I actually like have closed it when it got too busy because I was also trying to stay on top of my schoolwork. So it's 100% like a side thing for me, but it is fun to like play pretend being a art business owner.
A lot of the things that Fia draws are pop cultural things. Plenty of Marvel characters and celebrities, Timothy Chalamet and Conan Gray, and of course, Harry Styles. Fia isn't actually an art student, but she is really good at drawing, and she enjoys the process as well, so she figured she might as well post her creations on the internet. Nowadays, she doesn't actively try to gain more followers on her Instagram account, which is the main platform she uses, but she says for a while,
I had a big phase where I was like trying to do follow trains and comment on art following boost posts. But the problem for art creators online is that you have to have a very specific niche that you are consistent in.
One of Fia's drawings, an oil pastel of Harry Styles' watermelon sugar pose, if you know what I'm talking about, did especially well on her TikTok.
At first, I was like, well, I should keep on doing this because this is what people really liked from me. And I suddenly felt this pressure to keep creating specifically oil pastel drawings of Harry Styles or similar celebrities. I like having grown my followers a little bit and people buying my art. But artistically, I quickly lost interest. I wasn't really doing what really appealed to me. I love Harry Styles and I love his music, but I'm not like a mega fan of his, I'd say. So then I moved away from that a little bit. I started drawing just whatever came to mind, whichever person or image that I wanted to create. And I saw my follower count starting to drop because people were following me for the Harry Styles content, which I was no longer providing. But I was okay with that. Like, I'm not a professional artist, I'm not an art student, and I don't have any real need to, like, garner a big following. I didn't want to brand myself and limit myself to what I could draw or post.
One of the consequences of having an audience all the time is having audience feedback all the time. And for a hobbyist like Fia, she doesn't really need to worry about what other people want to see from her. But what about the art students who do want to create an online presence, who want to cultivate a brand for themselves and to reach a large audience? If what Fia said about making art online is true, if the algorithms do indeed reward consistency over authenticity, then how does that feedback loop affect the creative processes of emerging professional artists? For this, I talked to Anya Butler, a character animation student at the California Institute of Art, though she's probably better known by her online handle, Mepity. That is M-E-P-P-I-T-Y. In 2017, when she was just 16 years old, her favorite band, Gorillaz, has just released a new album called Humans. Around the same time, she was becoming more serious about getting into art school and studying animation. As a fun practice, Anya made this animatic, which is this choppier version of an animated music video, you could say. This animatic of one of the songs on the Gorillaz album. And she uploaded the video to YouTube.
There was no intention to actually post. I just felt like, you know, I've spent 3 weeks on this. I might as well do something with it. It was never for views or attention or anything. I just needed somewhere to post it.
If she's lucky, maybe a couple hundred strangers might see her video and like it. Within 24 hours, her video received over 100,000 views.
And that was the most validating thing I'd ever experienced. It was so unexpected. People were talking about it in the Gorillaz fandom. And so from that point, me loving attention, I was like, oh, I can do something with this. I now have a platform to post my creations.
Anya's YouTube channel is now close to reaching 150,000 subscribers, and one of her videos...
Hi, I'm Anya, also known as Mepity, and today is part one of two of looking through my CalArt sketchbooks.
Has surpassed 1 million views on YouTube.
I mean, just in general, having like almost 150k subscribers, that's like the entire population of the city I live in.
Oh my gosh.
What does that feel like?
God, it's so hard to comprehend. You know, it's a big number. It's bigger than I think any stadium can fit a person in these days. And so it doesn't feel very different, just purely because I cannot imagine it. As you said, it's the size of a city, and that's crazy to me that that many people have seen my art and enjoy me enough to click subscribe and stick around.
For the most part, Anya enjoys having a YouTube channel. She loves being able to share the behind the scenes on her creative projects, talk about her experiences at CalArts, and interact with her subscribers here and there in the comment section. Anya claims to be 96% extroverted, by the way. But sometimes, with such a huge number of people watching her, she feels like...
there's this expectation that I need to post, or that I have a duty to entertain. It really stunted me for a year, I would say. I was like, okay, people like my gorilla stuff, but maybe they don't like my personal stuff. When I did start posting my own stuff, and that was getting reasonably popular, I thought I needed to create a formula or a brand, because I know it works, rather than doing it for the enjoyment of it.
In 2019, Anya made a video where admittedly she got a little bit clickbaity for the title. The video was called Redesigning Characters from Has-Been Hotel, and in the thumbnail of the video, Anya slapped the word FIXED in all capital letters. Now, Has-Been Hotel is this adult web series, and the creators have released this 30-minute pilot of the animated show on YouTube, and it's really popular, and it has a very loyal fan base, as Anya was just about to find out.
I poked the bear. I critiqued a hugely beloved project. I did a critique of the character design and did some redesigns because I'm personally not a fan of the show, no hate to anyone who is, but I said FIXED in the thumbnail, and so a lot of people misinterpreted my clickbait title as me thinking that I'm, you know, holier than thou or whatever, and people didn't like that, and so death threats were a thing I've had to deal with ever since.
Here are some of the comments under the video just to give you a taste of what the hate is like. Quote, I'm just gonna say this flat out, if the characters looked like that, I would not watch the show. Another one, quote, you're basically just making a Walmart version of a Has-Been Hotel characters, laughing emoji with tears. And last one, quote, OMG, these fixed designs look like actual crap. I cannot imagine them moving, they feel like they are from different cartoons.
I would lie if I said it didn't hurt me. Like, of course it hurts. You know, with any piece of content I have posted, there will be an overwhelming amount of love. But then there's always going to be that one negative or hate comment that sticks out. And for some reason, that's the one that our brains decides to remember. And for a while, there were a lot of dislikes. Now there's more dislikes than likes, which is quite interesting. It's a very polarizing video. So yeah, it really stung seeing this much hate because I still stand by everything I said in the video. But the saving factor for me was learning more about the people who are making these comments. Most of them are very young and kind of don't have an understanding of social media and that behind each personality is a real person. And so I eventually learned to not take it to heart. It's just some 12-year-old kid who's butt hurt, and that helped a lot, but it took a while.
The internet has made it easy to share art, but it has also made it easy to share opinions. As soon as you click the upload button, you are subjecting yourself to the possible cruelty of the public. And that cruelty happens in real time. The reactions to your work are immediate. For Anya, she had to learn to cope with the aftermath of people's judgments of her ideas and to move on from the facetious and malicious comments. But for some artists, the anticipation of judgment begins before the pen even touches the paper. And that anticipation can be paralyzing.
It's just this unreasonable expectation that just manifests.
This is Tara Asadi. She's currently an art student from Capilano University.
I always find myself being harsh on my work. Even though they're meant to be imperfect, I feel frustrated that they aren't perfect. Slowly, those small thoughts here and there manifest into thoughts about how nothing I will make will be up to that industry standard, and no idea I come up with will ever be quote-unquote good.
Truth be told, we've known each other since grade 7. She was always that kid who carried a sketchbook around, and she's incredibly nice, really soft-spoken. If you ask Tara to throw you something from across the room, she'll walk that entire distance and pass it directly in your hand instead.
For me, there's satisfaction to giving. So there's only a few rare cases where I create it for me and I enjoyed creating it. There's always that little voice in my head. It's like, oh, what's the point in creating this? You're not even going to show it. Or you could have spent this time doing something that you could have shown to other people instead.
In a way, we've returned to the original question about the value of art without a viewer. But this time, not from a place of limitation, as is the case with physical galleries, but from a place of abundance. Everything that Tara makes can be shared online. So why draw anything that won't be? If an artist has the ability to share everything, then the question becomes, why make something that isn't meant for an audience? This is Don Portalance. He's a well-known artist around the Greater Vancouver area, and he was the private art teacher for me, Fia, and Tara. He's never told us his real age.
I'm going to have my 100th birthday any day now.
But he's definitely been around before the internet. Actually, Don taught himself art at a young age by hand-copying out art books from the library.
Oh, yeah. Well, you couldn't make prints in those days. I had to write the books out. And I just learned to do things myself. I did all kinds of stuff. At the age of 14 or so, I was stretching canvases and learning how to do stuff on my own from a book. Matter of fact, I first started drawing portraits. I was a paper boy. And we'd have to wait for the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I would draw pictures of the kids sitting around.
Yeah, well, when you make art at that age, did you have an audience in mind? Did you imagine that there would be somebody who was looking at it? Or were you painting purely because you wanted to paint?
Did I want an audience? Yeah, I was an only kid. I spent a lot of time trying to impress people that, hey, I can do this. Look what I made. You know?
Mm.
And which I suppose is something I think every creative person tends to have that. Creative people are trying to say something. So if you try to say something, it's a communication. You need somebody else there. So sure, I wanted an audience, and I wanted to impress people with my skill. This gave me a chance to shine, you know?
Even though Don clearly had artistic talent and desire from a young age, he didn't go to art school. Instead, he went to study education and became a teacher.
You didn't have the option of being an artist, you know?
Right.
You had to make a living, and I taught. I found out that I actually had a gift for teaching.
As a student of his, I can confirm that Don is a really good teacher. His art classes happened on Thursday evenings in his home studio, a room that he built himself in the basement. stepping into the studio felt like stepping through a portal. You have these mid-century chairs, various cabinets with tools for making your own frame or canvas, paintbrushes by the bucket, a red metal drawer, and a life-size skeleton that he claims to be one of his misbehaving students, and of course, lots and lots of paintings. Would you spend hours on a painting without knowing that there would be an audience for it?
Oh, yeah, I just painted because I wanted to paint, you know. I mean, I didn't care whether something was going to be exhibited or not. I just do it for me. I want to see if I can do it. Nobody's going to see it. I don't care. I just do it for me.
At first, Don's response really confused me. Because if you remember what he said a couple minutes ago.
Did I want an audience? Yeah.
And now he was saying that.
Nobody's going to see it. I don't care.
But then he cleared things up for me.
You know, sure. Like, that sounds in contradiction to what I said earlier, that you need an audience. Eventually, yeah. But you don't need an audience for every cotton picking thing you're doing. Sometimes you're just, you're going to allow yourself to try something and fail.
Right.
I've got piles of things sitting around that nobody's ever seen.
Right, and you don't feel guilty for spending so much time on those things?
No, I didn't waste my time. I was solving a problem. It doesn't matter what you're creating something. And you're creating it to solve your own problems. You're not creating it for other people. You're creating it to see if you can do this.
In some way or another, the people I've been talking to all agree that art is a form of communication. It seems like an audience is so inherent to any form of communication that when an artist doesn't show their work to the world, you begin to question whether if it's worth anything at all. But the thing is, figuring out how to communicate is a form of communication too. What you're making may never see the light of day, but it will show up in your future work somehow, in the way you draw certain things, the way you approach new ideas, the way you touch an audience. As Anya puts it,
art is a ticking time bomb, where if you're going to make something and no one sees it, it's still going to inform the work you do in the future, which may get seen.
Even on an institutional level, going back to the Vancouver Art Gallery collection, sure, Emily Carr's Big Raven should be seen, but it doesn't have to be seen now. Here's Mandy again.
It's not about the narcissism of the now, but thinking about maybe this will have value for another curator or another audience down the road that we can't predict. Something could be in the collection and be in storage for many years and be unknown to the public. And then maybe there's somebody doing research someday who reads about it and wants to see it, and then they decide they want to exhibit it. And so then it becomes visible again in a different way and feeds a different conversation or feeds a different generation of artists. So in that regard, just because it's not on display doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have value.
A tree falls in a forest and nobody, not even a squirrel, heard the slightest hint of its crashing. The tree starts to decay, with moss taking over its bark and mushrooms growing inside increasingly large hollows. Decades pass, maybe even centuries. Eventually, something takes root on top of the dank cushion of what used to be a tree. The tree's been rotting here so long that all of its wood has turned into a rich, nutritious foundation for the new plant, which doesn't take long to sprout and stretch into a healthy sapling. Soon enough, the song of birds fill over the location where the tree used to be. So if a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, don't worry, you will hear it somehow, just in the future. Special thanks to all of my interviewees for agreeing to speak with me. That is Tara Asadi, Anya Butler, and Mandy Jensen, Sophia Guan, and Don Portalance. The music you've heard throughout this program is also composed by the wonderfully talented Anya Butler. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional unceded territory of the Hankaminam-speaking Musqueam people on UBC Point Grey campus. Thanks for all your attention. I'm Diyang Feng.